So I'll be reading this morning from Ajahn Tanasaro's book, With Each and Every Breath. And I will start in the chapter called Basic Premises. When you want to master a meditation technique, it's good to know the premises underlying the technique. That way you have a clear idea of what you're getting into. Knowing the premises also helps you understand how and why the technique is supposed to work. If you have doubts about the premises, you can try them on as working hypotheses to see if they really do help in dealing with the problems of stress and suffering. Meditation doesn't require that you swear allegiance to anything you can't fully understand, but it does ask you to give its premises a serious try. As your meditation progresses, you can apply the basic premises to areas that come up in your meditation that aren't explained in the book. In this way, the meditation becomes less of a foreign technique and more of your own path in exploring the mind and solving its problems as they arise. Because breath meditation is a training in which the mind focuses on the breath, its basic premises focus on two topics, the workings of the mind and the workings of the breath. The word mind here covers not only the intellectual side of the mind, but also its emotional side together with its will to act. In other words, the word mind covers what we normally think of as heart as well. The mind is not passive. Because it's responsible for a body with many needs, it has to take an active approach to experience. Its actions shape its experience as it looks for food, both mental and physical, to keep itself and the body nourished. It's driven by hungers, both physical and mental. We're all familiar with the need to feed physically. Mentally, the mind feeds both externally and internally on relationships and emotions. Externally, it hungers for such things as love, recognition, status, power, wealth, and praise. Internally, it feeds off its love for others and its own self-esteem, as well as the pleasures that come from emotions both healthy and not, honor, gratitude, greed, lust, and anger. At any given moment, the mind is presented with a wide range of sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and tactile sensations and ideas. From this range, it chooses which things to focus attention on and which to ignore in its search for food. These choices shape the world of its experience. This is why if you and I walk through a store at the same time, for example, we will experience different stores to the extent that we're looking for different things. The mind's search for nourishment is constant and never-ending because its food, especially its mental food, is always threatening to run out. Whatever satisfaction it derives from its food is always short-lived. No sooner has the mind found a place to feed than it's already looking for where to feed next. Should it stay here? Should it go somewhere else? These incessant questions of what's next, where next, drive its search for well-being. But because these questions are the questions of hunger, they themselves keep eating away at the mind. Driven by hunger to keep answering these questions, the mind often acts compulsively, sometimes willfully, out of ignorance, misunderstanding what causes unnecessary stress and what doesn't. This causes it to create even more suffering and stress. The purpose of meditation is to end this ignorance and to root out the questions of hunger that keep driving it. An important aspect of this ignorance is the mind's blindness to its own inner workings in the present moment, for the present moment is where choices are made. Although the mind often acts under the force of habit, it doesn't have to. It has the option of making new choices with every moment. The more clearly you see what's happening in the present, the more likely you are to make skillful choices, ones that will lead to genuine happiness, and, with practice, will bring you closer and closer to total freedom from suffering and stress, now and into the future. Meditation focuses your attention on the present moment because the present moment is where you can watch the workings of the mind and direct them in a more skillful direction. The present is only the moment in time where you can act and bring about change. The Committee of the Mind. One of the first things you learn about the mind as you get started in meditation is that it has many minds. This is because you have many different ideas about how to satisfy your hungers and find well-being, and many different desires based on those ideas. These ideas boil down to different notions about what constitutes happiness, where it can be found, and what you are as a person, your needs for particular kinds of pleasure, and your abilities to provide those pleasures. Each desire thus acts as a seed for a particular sense of who you are and the world you live in. The Buddha had a technical term for this sense of self-identity in a particular world of experience. He called it becoming. Take note of this term and the concept behind it, for it's central to understanding why you cause yourself stress and suffering and what's involved in learning how to stop. If the concept seems foreign to you, think of when you're drifting off to sleep and an image of a place appears in the mind. You enter into the image, lose touch with the world outside, and that's when you've entered the world of a dream. That world of a dream, plus your sense of having entered into it, is a form of becoming. Once you have become sensitive to this process, you'll see that you engage in it even when you're awake, and many times in the course of a day. To gain freedom from the stress and suffering it can cause, you're going to have to examine the many becomings you create in your search for food, the self spawned by your desires, and the worlds they inhabit. For only when you've examined these things thoroughly can you gain release from their limitations. You'll find that, in some cases, different desires share common ideas of what happiness is and who you are, such as your desires for establishing a safe and stable family. In others, their ideas conflict, as when your desires for your family conflict with your desires for immediate pleasure regardless of its consequences. Some of your desires relate to the same mental worlds, others to conflicting mental worlds, and still others to mental worlds totally divorced from one another. The same goes for different senses of you inhabiting each of these worlds. Some of your yous are in harmony, others are incompatible, and still others are totally unrelated to one another. So there are many different ideas of you in your mind, each with its own agenda. Each of these yous is a member of the committee of the mind. This is why the mind is less like a single mind and more like an unruly throng of people. Lots of different voices with lots of different opinions about what you should do. Some members of the committee are open and honest about the assumptions underlying their central desires. Others are more obscure and devious. This is because each committee member is like a politician, with its own supporters and strategies for satisfying their desires. Some committee members are idealistic and honorable. Others are not. So the mind's committee is less like a communion of saints planning a charity event, and more like a corrupt city council, with the balance of power constantly shifting between different factions and many deals being made in back rooms. One of the purposes of meditation is to bring these dealings out into the open so that you can bring more order to the committee, so that your desires for happiness work less at cross purposes and more in harmony as you realize that they don't always have to be in conflict. Thinking of these desires as a committee also helps you realize that when the practice of meditation goes against some of your desires, it doesn't go against all of your desires. You're not being starved. You don't have to identify with the desires being thwarted through meditation, because you have other, more skillful desires to identify with. The choice is yours. You can also use the more skillful members of the committee to train the less skillful ones so that they stop sabotaging your efforts to find a genuine happiness. Always remember that genuine happiness is possible, and the mind can train itself to find that happiness. These are probably the most important premises underlying the practice of breath meditation. There are many dimensions to the mind, dimensions often obscured by the squabbling of the committee members and their fixation with fleeting forms of happiness. One of those dimensions is totally unconditioned. In other words, it's not dependent on conditions at all. It's not affected by space or time. It's an experience of total, unalloyed freedom and happiness. This is because it's free from hunger and free and from the need to feed. But even though this dimension is unconditioned, it can be attained by changing the conditions in the mind, developing the skillful members of the committee so that your choices become more and more conducive to genuine happiness. This is why the path of meditation is called a path. It's like a path to a mountain. Even though the path doesn't cause the mountain, and your walking on the path doesn't cause the mountain, the act of walking along the path can take you to the mountain. Or you can think of the unconditioned dimension as like the fresh water and salt water. The ordinary mind is like salt water, which makes you sick when you drink it. If you simply let the salt water still, the fresh water won't separate out on its own. You have to make an effort to distill it. The act of distilling doesn't create fresh water. It simply brings out the fresh water already there, providing you with all the nourishment you need to quench your thirst. Training the mind. The training that gets you to the mountain and provides you with fresh water has three aspects: virtue, concentration, and discernment. Virtue is the skill with which you interact with other people and living beings at large based on the intention to cause no harm to yourself or others. This is a topic we will consider in part 3 in the discussion of issues that commonly arise when integrating meditation into daily life. But it's important to note here why virtue is related to meditation. If you act in harmful ways, when you sit down to meditate, the knowledge of that harm gets in the way of staying firmly in the present moment. If you react with regret over the harm you've done, you find it difficult to stay settled in the present moment with confidence. If you react with denial, you build inner walls in your awareness that create more opportunities for ignorance and make it harder to look directly at what's really going on in the mind. The best way to avoid these two reactions is to stick to the intention of not doing anything harmful in the first place, and then make up your mind to follow that intention with more and more skill. If you've seen that you have acted unskillfully, acknowledge your mistake, recognize that regret won't erase the mistake, and resolve not to repeat that mistake in the future. This is the most that can be asked of a human being living in time, where our actions aimed at shaping the future can be based only on knowledge of the past and present. The second aspect of training is concentration. Concentration is the skill of keeping the mind centered on a single object, such as the breath, with a sense of ease, refreshment, and equanimity. Equanimity being of the ability to watch things without falling under the sway of likes and dislikes. Attaining concentration requires developing three qualities of mind. Alertness, the ability to know what's happening in the body and mind while it's happening. Ardency, the desire and effort to abandon any unskillful qualities that might arise in the mind and to develop skillful qualities in their place. Mindfulness, the ability to keep something in mind. In the case of breath meditation, this means remembering to stay with the breath and to maintain the qualities of alertness and ardency with every in and out breath. When these three qualities become strong, they can bring the mind to a state of strong concentration called jhana, or meditative absorption, which we will discuss in part 4. Because jhana is based on desire, the desire to keep skillful qualities in the mind, it too is a form of becoming. But it's a special form of becoming that allows you to see the process of becoming in action. At the same time, the ease and refreshment provided by jhana are health food for the mind, enabling you to abandon any of the unskillful eating habits that would pull you off the path. Because the supply of mental food coming from jhana is steady, it takes some of the pressure off your need to feed. This allows you to step back from the questions of hunger and to look at them through the questions of discernment, seeing where the stress of feeding is unnecessary and how you can master the skills to go beyond this. This is why jhana is central to the path of training. The third aspect of training is discernment. Discernment is the ability to distinguish the skillful processes in the mind from the unskillful ones, to understand how to abandon what's unskillful and to develop what's skillful, and to know how to motivate yourself so that you can abandon unskillful processes and to develop skillful processes even when you're not in the mood. You learn these abilities by listening to others, as when you read a book like this one, and by observing your own actions and asking the right questions about them. In the beginning, you step back from the questions of hunger, which demand an answer right now as to where and what to feed on next, and take stock of how you've been feeding. In what ways do your feeding habits lead to stress? In what ways is that stress unnecessary? To what extent is it worth it? In other words, to what extent does the pleasure gained from feeding compensate for the stress? In the beginning stages, as you develop virtue and try to master concentration, the questions of discernment are simply looking for better ways to feed. In other words, they're refined versions of the questions of hunger. You come to realize that the pleasure you gained from carelessly acting in harmful ways or letting the mind wander where it will isn't worth the stress it entails. You begin to see where the stress you thought was unavoidable isn't really necessary. You have other, better ways of finding inner nourishment, feeding on the higher pleasures that virtue and concentration provide. As your concentration develops, your discernment into the levels of stress in the mind gets more and more refined, so that your sense of what is and isn't skillful gets more refined as well. As you keep applying the questions of discernment even to your practice of jhana, you begin to wonder if it might be possible to escape the stress that comes even with the most refined sort of feeding. What sort of skill would that involve? This is where the questions of discernment are no longer just a refined version of the questions of hunger. They become noble questions in that they take you beyond the need to feed. They bring dignity to your search for happiness. They help you uncover the dimension where even feeding on jhana is no longer necessary. And when that dimension is finally uncovered, all stress comes to an end. The questions of noble discernment concerning unnecessary stress, the actions that cause it, and the actions that can help put an end to it, are related to one of the Buddha's most famous teachings, the Four Noble Truths. The fact of unnecessary stress is the first truth. The unskillful mental actions that cause it are the second, the fact that it can come to an end is the third, and the skillful actions that bring it to an end are the fourth. These truths are noble for three reasons. One, they're absolute. They're true for everyone everywhere, so they're not just a matter of personal opinion or your cultural background. Two, they provide a guidance for a noble path of practice. They teach you not to deny or run away from the stress you're causing, but to acknowledge it and face it until you comprehend it. When you comprehend it, you can see the causes of that stress in your actions and abandon them. You develop the skillful actions that put an end to stress so that you can realize freedom from stress for yourself. The third reason these truths are noble is that when you use the questions underlying them to examine and question your actions, they lead ultimately to a noble attainment, a genuine happiness that puts an end to the need to feed, and so causes no harm to anyone at all. Because discernment is aimed at bringing your actions to the highest level of skill, it grows directly out of the quality of ardency in your concentration. However, it also builds on alertness in seeing which actions lead to which results, and it informs mindfulness so that you can remember the lessons you've learned from what you've observed and can apply them in the future. In fact, all three aspects of the training, virtue, concentration, and discernment, help one another along. Virtue makes it easier to settle down in concentration and to be honest with yourself in discerning which members of the mind's committee are skillful and which ones are not. Concentration provides the mind with a sense of refreshment that allows it to resist unskillful urges that would create lapses in virtue and the stability it needs to discern clearly what's actually going on inside. Discernment provides strategies for developing virtue, along with an understanding of the mind's workings that allow it to settle down in ever stronger states of concentration. Virtue, concentration, and discernment, in turn, are all based on the most fundamental part of the training, the practice of generosity. In being generous with your belongings, your time, your energy, your knowledge, and your forgiveness, you create a space of freedom in the mind. Instead of being driven by your various appetites, you can step back and realize the joy that comes when you're not a slave to hunger all the time. This realization provides your basic impetus to look for a happiness where you don't need to feed at all. Seeing the good that comes from giving, you can learn to approach the practice of virtue and meditation not just with an eye to what you can get out of it, but also with an eye to what you can give to the practice. The training of the mind becomes a gift both for yourself and for the people around you. So, all in all, the premises of breath meditation are based on four observations about the mind that the Buddha called the Four Noble Truths, The mind experiences stress and suffering. The stress and suffering come from the way the mind shapes its experience through its actions driven by ignorance. That ignorance can be ended, opening your awareness to an unconditioned dimension free of stress and suffering. That dimension, even though it's unconditioned, can be reached by training the mind in skillful qualities of virtue, concentration, and discernment. The purpose of breath meditation is to help with that training.
A common kind of theme for me that comes up is like I have like in my head certain conditions that I feel like I need to be or need to have in order to like really kind of practice.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, just please talk about that.
Well, I mean, it's there is a certain element of external conditions that are helpful, but that's one of the things that particularly, say, Ajahn Chah was very skilled in trying to get us to learn how to adapt our practice to conditions that we find. And the awareness and discernment to not create suffering, because trying to get the perfect conditions can be really stressful. And then in the end, because we're driven by desires and we've got so many committee members that are all have their different agendas, then even when you get the perfect conditions, oftentimes you don't recognize them because you're already thinking about something else into the future of how you'd like it to be, or thinking about how it was in the past and you miss the fact that you actually have the conditions. So there's learning how to understand the mind is how you can create the conditions that facilitate one's ability to practice anywhere, really. You know, there's some obvious places that aren't suitable, but for the most part, you know, we recognize that. And the Buddha didn't recommend setting up Buddhist monasteries next to bars and nightclubs and gambling casinos. And for the most part, we're in pretty good conditions already. And the ability to reflect and investigate and understand how to develop a continuity of attention, awareness, reflection, investigation is really what's important. There's a monk who went to live with Ajahn Chah years ago, and he was he's actually very adept at meditation, very skilled, and he said one of the things that really hooked him to study and stick with Ajahn Chah was Ajahn Chah sort of saying something like,
you can go off to the forest and be happy, you know, on your own, or you can stay here and I can teach you how to be happy all the time.
Yeah. And that's an important skill that takes time. But it also learning how to adapt to these different conditions. Yeah.
So Long Paul Rajan, Jeff often is talking about breath meditation. He talks about an expansive awareness in the body. And I've been going back and forth between that expansive awareness in the body and also just taking in the entire sense field as I can. But then it's also the capacity to turn around and narrow focus. I mean, consciousness is this dividing of the known, it seems.
Yeah.
And if one, you know, narrows it, I mean, the capacity to be concentrated and then go through various meditative attainments will be that way. But this expansive, I'm quite intrigued by that kind of knowing expansively. But I'm like, unsure if that way or more concentrated, like to a point. It seems to continue to be, to move towards taking as much in as I can in like just balanced way. Just being aware of everything that I can kind of, you know, because to me it's that kind of that I'm leaning towards is that, you know, it seems to me that the cessation of consciousness is not like the cessation of knowing, it's the cessation of that dividing of knowing.
Right. And a lot of it is the getting a feel for how does the mind stay bright? How does the mind stay centered? How does the mind stay clear? And so sometimes you want to let that expansive quality let that work, and then because that's something that one can carry with one. But then sometimes, say, it expands a bit too much. So then that's okay, back to an anchor. And because what that does is then it energizes the mind. It focuses it again. It kind of sharpens the ability of the mind to stay with the object. So it then gains a bit more boom for strength. So there's a experimenting with how to carry that. But you always have to be paying attention to what the results are. It's that continuity of clarity and stability that's important. Because similarly, one can start to focus, and then it starts to get narrow and tight and fearful, even kind of timid, so that it starts shrinking and then doesn't like to be contact. So that it's like benefits and the gratification and the dangers of everything, even with concentration. How the mind concentrates has a certain pleasing quality, or it has its drawback to it, so to be able to get a feel for that.
I've never heard anyone say divided consciousness. Is that the same thing as saying divided awareness?
No, I mean the actual word vijnana, jnana is means knowledge, and vi means to divide. So that's actually the function of consciousness, is to divide and separate. And so that inherently it has a you're having you're subject and object is being divided, internal, external, me and observer as. And without that, then it's just this amorphous field of sensory data, which because of that, that's impossible. So vijnana has an essential function, but then it has an inherent limitation as well, and that's where learning how to let the mind settle and expand or to draw its constant commentary so that it can just see things more immediately or clearly.
He said, I remember a long, long time ago, I read an article about this guy who was born blind. He had something very minimal wrong with his eye, and they were able to correct it. So, like, as an adult, and he all of a sudden got vision, 20/20 vision, but he had no clue of how to use it. His consciousness, he had never developed around that, so his mind is trying to smell it, or trying to taste it, or trying to hear it.
It's also greater questions and answers for Buddha. What is consciousness? Consciousness is a Mahakutika, probably.
Probably Mahakutika.
It's
a great question to answer.
But it's vijnana, is it the word he uses? To cognize? Bhikkhu translated it as cognize, but I checked out that word and it is specifically becoming aware or divided, and then divided knowing again is emphasized in that word. But I mean, I think it's, I really also, not only is it the subject-object duality, but it's also, I think Western inclines us to think of consciousness as the, what the Buddha would term as the sense sphere. Mm. And when we choose something, utilizing name and form, we're actually dividing an object or a particular thing out of that sense sphere and saying, this is that.
Right.
And so it's not only that duality of dividing between ourselves, it's also dividing anything out of the potential sense field of hearing or...
Right.
But, it's all good stuff.
it's great stuff. It's really, the fundamentals of how we construct a world and a self. So that understanding that process, so that we're not, because that's the fundamental delusion or avijja, lack of true knowledge. Where the Buddha said that's the fundamental root of suffering. It's just not having this true knowledge of the way things work, the way things function, how we construct the sense of me, how we construct the world, and how we react to it, how we fit into it.
Also from that sit-down questions, I think it's one of those, but I think it's the Mahavidyala Sutta. It's another really interesting question to ask, where what's the difference, what's the distinction between vijnana and panya?
Right.
And I'm also quite, like, thought about like English translations, like Ajahn uses discernment for panya, which I think is great.
Yeah.
But also you look it up in the dictionary and it also has the connotations of what we would say is vijnana, that figure ground discernment. You're choosing details out of your sense field.
Mm.
And to me this question sort of speaks to how maybe even in the Buddha's time that distinction was not exactly clear.
Mm-hmm.
And so I put the answers by saying, vijnana is to be understood, and panya is to be developed.
Mm-hmm.
So, using that discernment to investigate the process of vijnana.
Well, potentially the way of seeing that discernment is the knowing of that nature of dividing. So you're discerning that the nature of consciousness is to divide or not divide, or expand or contract.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is interesting in the sense that if one looks at it in terms of those processes of a conditioned nature, then, say, vijnana is a karmic resultant, and wisdom or discernment is a causal process that we cultivate. Whereas vijnana is something that's already functioning because of causes in the second place. Okay, we've got a few things to call. Great.